Why don't you take me through what your enrollment is like right now? What sort of numbers are you seeing?
That's an odd question because it means different things. So, are you talking about membership? Are you talking about worship attendance?
Both.
So within the, I don't know how Jim explained it to you or not, but we live in a culture right now that is very different from anything that was experienced even in the 1980s. Okay? So right now, people's average worship attendance is like once a month at best. So those folks in the 60s who were coming to church three or four times a month, those folks now in this new millennial are once a month. Our worship attendance is probably 150, somewhere around there, a week. When we're all here, it's probably close, like at Easter, our worship attendance at Easter is a little over 400. But it's Easter. Just like Christmas. You know, those are two different times. But our average attendance is about 150. We're up in average worship attendance since I got here in 2010. But we're not necessarily up in membership.
Yeah, how has membership changed over the years?
Well, people are less inclined to be part of institutions now, whether that's the Masons or the VFW or the church or the Alumni Association. So they're more inclined to be part of something, but less inclined to be part of a member. So Alumni Association is a good example. What's the benefit of an Alumni Association?
Well, you can connect with other alumni.
Right. But what do you mostly hear from the Alumni Association?
To be fair, I can't say I've only been an alumni for a few years.
Hello, it's our national fundraising time, you know, I mean, that's it for the most part. And if you've had a great experience at college, then yeah, you do connect with alumni, especially if you're from a small college. But if you're from a UMass like me or Boston University School of Theology or a big school, chances are you didn't, you know, you didn't have a tight group of people, you know, unless you were part of a small school, like maybe a journalism school or something like that. And in the Methodist Church, the only advantage to being a member is that you get to vote on legal issues in the church. And so, is it worth it? Some people say yes, some people say no. I would venture to say if you asked most of the people at Carter, they would say they were a member, even though they may not be an official member. This is where they attend, this is where they're invested. This is where maybe their kids are in Sunday school, or this is where they worship on a regular basis, or this is, you know, the place where they find their spiritual lives connected. And so we don't, I shouldn't say we. I don't make a big deal about membership. That's not as important to me as people being connected in community and feeling, you know, part of something larger than that. Membership was a big thing in the 50s and 60s because that's institutionally, that's what you did. So you were a member of the Rotary Club, you were a member of the Masons, you were a member of this, and membership meant that you belonged to something. Whereas now it's more, there's a model that you belonged and then you believed, then you believed in a certain amount of, what I want to use, common goals. Now people are more interested in the common goals than they are in the structure of membership.
So, have you seen enrollment decrease over your time at the
Oh,
church?
in my time, it's been flat. But in the 60s, this congregation was a membership of 1,300.
So, since the history of the church, yeah, how was the history of the church
Well,
membership?
this church has been here for 150 years. But in the heyday of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you know, the membership was over a thousand, I mean, over 1,000. Worship attendance was well over 600, you know, a week.
So more than six times what it is now.
Yeah. And that's pretty much I would say the way of most mainline denominations in the Catholic Church. You know, there may be independent churches that can boast a particular increase in membership or an increase in worship attendance, but they're not looking at the long-term history. Across the board, I don't think you'll find anybody that'll argue with you, but across the board, mainline denominations, including the Roman Catholic Church, have been in decline for 40 years.
So what you're saying is the biggest problem is that there's this lack of joining with these institutions. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think America is becoming more and more secular. And so how do you find, the church has been hurt by a variety of things, by scandal, by millennials and, let's start with boomers, which I am, where you began to have less faith in institutions, less faith in politics and all those other kinds of things. You have millennials that, so my daughter's 31. She goes to church. My son's 20. He doesn't. But most of my, friends who have kids in their 20s and 30s, they don't go to church. Why is that? Well, because they didn't go to church. The parents didn't go to church, right? And church for some is it's a learned experience in some ways, and so that's and then when they have kids, like my daughter just had a child, they end up not going to church at the same time. So there's that going on, distrust in institutions. There's the hypocrisy of some people feel about the church, that the people that come to church espouse certain values, but they don't practice them. There's the fact that the church, in my opinion, has been co-opted by language by political language. So I consider myself a progressive evangelical, meaning that I believe that I have a progressive agenda with regards to human rights, sexuality, women's rights, the whole nine yards, but I'm also an evangelical. But as soon as somebody says, you're an evangelical, what comes across? Well, you're a Trump supporter, or you're right wing, or you're a fundamentalist, or you're crazy. I mean, there's lots of terms that people use around that. So that language has been co-opted politically, which happened in Reagan years with the, the moral majority and all that other kind of stuff.
And how have you felt that, how have you felt the effects at the church with this decrease in the younger generations getting involved in the church?
I have to say we have not felt that as strongly here as I have in other churches that I've pastored. So we have, probably 15 or 20 young adults and young married couples here too, both gay and straight. My staff here, my director of faith formation is 31. She's a deacon in the Methodist Church. Director of music is 28. She's a deacon in the United Methodist Church, but meaning that they're ordained in the United Methodist Church. So we have a very young staff at the same time. I don't see that as much. Now, if I was in Newburyport or Lynn or something like that, I would probably see that to a greater degree. But here, I don't see it as much. And I don't know what the answer to that is, to be honest with you. I don't know why millennials and other younger folks. There used to be this pattern where I'm one of them, you'd go to church with your parents or whatever, you'd go to college and didn't go to church for 4 years or whatever the length of time was, and then you got married in a church, you had a family, and you just naturally navigated back to that because you wanted your family to have the same kind of sort of values. But I would say for many millennials, some of those values, when you get into the church is hypocritical, they don't see those values as positive. You know, I get that. That makes sense to me. In particular, the values of, you see it a little bit more now, but, you know, the whole pre-sex abuse scandal has hurt all of us. I mean, it's because it raises a level of distrust, and that the institutions, whether they're Catholic or Protestant or whatever, don't have the capacity to monitor themselves.
What are some of these hypocrisies that you think are really at the forefront?
Well, if you listen, David Kennard did some work a long time ago millennials see the church as that all they do is ask for money. That's all they're about, is asking for money. That they're homophobic. And this is the general, it's not this church or this church, this is the general sense overall, that they're homophobic, that they don't practice what they believe. You know, they say, oh, we love everybody, but really not so, or really we just love this person or that person. That they don't care about the world and social justice issues in the world. They only care about saving your soul. You know, so the punch card is, if you will, I believe in Jesus, and therefore I'm set. I don't have to do anything else. Well, that's not how it works. But these are the preconceived notions, if you will, that are out there. And they're hard to address. They're easy to address from the pulpit in a local church, but they're hard to address out there, unless you're out there at the local baseball game or whatever, and you can have those kind of conversations back and forth.
So what kind of things are you guys doing here to sort of try to engage people in the community and try to up enroll them?
I don't think that we... It's Stefan or Stefan?
Stefan.
Stefan. I really don't think we do things intentionally to up enrollment. I would say I don't think that's the case. I think we do things here because they're the right things to do. And so we try to be involved as a church in local things like Needham Green, or our members are on parts of, you know, we have members that are on the board of directors for Needham Community Service or Rosie's Place or things like that. We tend to identify ourselves as having a strong mission program. The Pumpkins, for example, is a good example of that. I know you've been around for at least a couple of years.
Year and a half now.
Year and a half, okay. Like the Pumpkins out there, none of that money stays with the church. That all goes to charity within the community and for disaster relief and stuff like that. So our members come in, they unload all the pumpkins, and they staff the pumpkin patch, and it all goes away. So none of it stays here. So it's the same with other charity kinds of things we've done. But 3 years ago, we raised over $50,000 for Imagine No Malaria, which was a UN 2020 millennial goal. So that's it. We did the bike ride with the Needham with the Needham Community Council for food banks in this area. So hopefully, mission trips. We had 32 people that were doing work down in Houston for Hurricane Harvey in July. You know, so we try to put our faith in our hands and in action.
And what do your demographics at the church look like? How much are older, seniors, families, children?
I'm going to guess because I don't know. But it's an interesting question as I think about it. I would say of those that regularly attend every week, I would categorize them as primarily seniors. 55 and older, let's say. Of those that are in worship on a twice a month basis, I would say that drops by 10 or 15 years.
Okay.
Our Sunday school and nursery, you know, so we've got, a lot of times you look at a church by their nursery numbers, you know, like, we have 8 kids in our nursery. We don't have, I mean, they're all under the age of 3. You know, so somebody's having babies out there, you know, so you got that going on. Our young adult group is going well, our high school group's going well. We have this 30-40 group that's going well. We're doing more and more work now in spiritual life formation. And so we have 5 of those groups going on, and one of them is just specifically for, folks in their 30s, mid-30s, early 40s kind of thing. So I guess I would say on an average Sunday, it's probably, say the average age is somewhere between 45 and 50, somewhere around there. If you look at the average age of the denomination as a whole, it's older than me. I'm 65. It's probably closer to 68.
Okay. And what have you heard? Have you heard from a lot of other pastors talking about this challenge in bringing up membership or seeing a decline in membership around town?
Around town, no, I have not. I like I said, I think every church struggles with it. Some of it is around pastoral leadership and changes that happen. You know, so every time there's a pastoral change, you know, people say, churches become, there's a sense of consumerism to it now. You know, what can I get from this church, if you will? Does it have, I mean, we have Methodists, we have people who teach at Methodist seminaries who go to church at the UCC church. Now you think, well, that's kind of odd, right? They teach at a Methodist seminary, but they go to the UCC church. Well, when they came here, we didn't have a youth program. And they had kids who were in high school. Well, where do you think they're going to go? They're going to go where their kids are connecting with people of their peers, you know, in school. That just makes perfect sense to me. Now, when people leave different churches, whether it's the Lutheran church or the Congregational church or the Baptist church or whatever, people sit back and they say, do I like this pastor? You know, is this working for me? And if it doesn't work, they come over here. So my 10 years here, or eight years here, I guess, you know, we've had Baptists come over, we've had Congregationalists come over, we've had Roman Catholics come over, and I'm sure we've lost our equal share to other churches in town at the same time, because there's so much identity with the clergy who are there, and I think most of the clergy are really trying to work out of that now by saying, no, you have to identify with the community. It's far more important for you to identify with the folks that are sitting next to you, because that's your community. I'm not your community. I come and go. You can fire me. You can do whatever you want with me. But I'm your facilitator. I'm your leader. But this is your community.